I'm Joe Bianca.
I'm Bill Finley.
I'm Jonathan Green.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 9:15, Wednesday, January 20th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And at the risk of this backfiring between now and when this airs, today is a good day to be an American.
Oh boy, Joe, I couldn't agree more. I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for Thoroughbred Daily News, and happy Inauguration Day, everybody.
Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable, and today also is a palindrome. Palindrome, the word of the day, which is basically a day that is, or a number that is the same forwards as backwards. And it's the first in a series of 10.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. Located in the horse capital of the world, Keeneland is an internationally renowned racecourse and the thoroughbred industry's leading auction house. Founded in 1936, Keeneland's mission is to continually invest in the industry and to preserve the tradition of thoroughbred racing. For more information, visit Keeneland.com. All right, so this weekend we have the Pegasus World Cup Invitational. It looks like there's going to be a big field. I think that's going to be a theme on Saturday at Gulfstream, and we're gonna question the future of the Pegasus a little bit here. But I think overall, the people at Gulfstream, Mike Lakow, those guys do a really good job putting together a really good deep card with a lot of big fields. So I think it's going to be a terrific wagering card. But you know, you look at the field and there's so little cachet compared to where this race was when it was first brought into the racing world. I mean, the only horse that I think you really are interested to see is Nick's Go, because he was so dominant towards the end of last season. And he's, I don't know, we talked about Charlatan being the most exciting horse in America in 2021, but Nick's Go is a pretty interesting horse as well, and to see where he goes from here. But I mean, you go through the rest of the field and it's just, there's nobody that really, you know, gets the pulse racing. Code of Honor, probably going to be second choice. Obviously he was almost 3-year-old champion. He won the Travers, but last year, not a great year for him. So he's trying to get himself back on track. Independence Hall is mildly interesting because he was a pretty good 3-year-old, but you know, he disappointed in the Malibu. So who knows what he's really going to be worth as a 4-year-old. And then just, you know, going down the field, you got Tax, True Timber, who won the Cigar Mile, Math Wizard. So you have some like lower level grade one winners, but I think the story of this race, unfortunately, is that the quality continues to deteriorate every year. And when it was first inaugurated, we had Arrogate, who had that dominant performance before going to Dubai. And then Gunrunner, I was actually there covering Gunrunner when he won the Pegasus. And, you know, it was such a big event. And it had such panache, you know, being so close to Miami. And it was a big party at Gulfstream. And, you know, I'm sure once they can have fans again, that you know, it'll draw a decent crowd. But it continues to go down in quality every single year. And, you know, it was already going up against the Dubai World Cup, but now you have the Saudi Cup as well. And, you know, I just wonder, you know, if this race is long for the game and whether or not they'll eventually just scrap it and go back to, you know, running the Don in February or whatever they had before. So I wonder about your guys' thoughts and whether or not you think this race is going to be, you know, ever what it was meant to be.
Joe, I'm going to agree with some of the things you said and disagree with some of the other things that you said. Obviously, I agree with the fact that this is the least exciting rendition of the Pegasus, or on paper, the worst field. But I don't think they'll get rid of it anytime soon, or nor should they. You know, first of all, look at what's going to happen Saturday. They're going to handle just like through the roof numbers. And it is a big day. I mean, in a normal year without COVID, it's still a big day. They get a lot of people to come out. They get a younger crowd, et cetera. So, you know, those factors going forward, there's a lot of reasons to keep the race. And I think they've come to the realization that they can't do what they did in the beginning. But look at the math. It was a $12 million race, then a $16 million race. Now it's $3 million. So $3 million is a lot less attractive, obviously, than $12 or $16 million. But they're running up against some factors that are really not anyone's fault. Number one is the Saudi Cup. I think that Charleston would be in this race if there was no Saudi Cup. Look at last year, the two most exciting horses at the time were Maximum Security and Midnight Bisou. They both passed the race to run in the Saudi Cup. So that's something that, you know, what are they going to do? They can't match the purse of the Saudi Cup. They're not going to make it a $20 million race. And the other factor, and it gets worse and worse every single year, which horses coming out of the Breeders' Cup Classic aren't retired? Only the ones that haven't accomplished enough to be stallions yet. You know, a horse like Tacitus, who has yet to win a grade one race, is pretty much the only horse that's come back out of the Breeders' Cup Classic to run. So those are factors that are out of their hands. I think this is going to be a little bit of an aberration. I don't think we'll get Arrowgate versus California Chrome type races in the Pegasus going forward. But at the same time, I think that this is probably a low point, and I think they will do better in the future. But I would not want to get rid of it, not at all. And I don't think that's in their plans.
Yeah, I think Gulfstream has done a really good job of marketing this race and making it a signature race. And part of it was because of the just, you know, tremendous purses that they were offering. And $3 million is still a lot of money. I mean, it's more than the majority of the Breeders' Cup races, you know, for that mark. So, you know, $3 million is still $3 million. These are not, you know, what I would consider top level graded horses. And, you know, Bill, you stole my thunder a little bit because I was going to mention that none of the horses, none of the 10 participants in the Breeders' Cup Classic, you know, lasted 6-7 more weeks to be able to run in the Pegasus. So that's kind of a disappointment. And there's a bunch of solid horses that I would love to own, that are running in the race, but nothing that, you know, that makes you say, hey, that's a destination site. I want to be there on Saturday, or at least be watching the race on Saturday, because I want to watch, you know, Arrogate, Gun Runner, City of Light, you know, even Mucho Gusto, you know, last year was an exciting race, but otherwise it's not something that generates a lot of interest, you know, in the grand scheme of things, especially when they're putting $3 million up, you know, in purse monies. You know, there are a couple other horses that I think are interesting just because the storylines are interesting. True Timber, you would love to see, you know, a fan of the show and friend of the show, Jack Sisterton, win a big race like that. I think that would be important after, you know, the horse won the Cigar Mile. That would be a really interesting back-to-back, you know, triumph for that horse. Math Wizard, because Chaos is King, they're friends of ours, and it'd be interesting to see them run well. You mentioned Joe Independence Hall, who, you know, after his first three or four races of his career, he looked like he was going to be just as good, if not better, than Tis the Law. And after winning his first three and then running second in the greatest stake race in Tampa. So there are a couple of horses that are of interest, but nothing that, you know, would make me kind of sit down in front of the screen if I wasn't already a fan of the industry.
Yeah, and I don't want to dump on the card too much, because I think it's going to be a really good wagering card with a lot of full fields. I think even some of the grade threes are going to have really high quality fields. But yeah, the story, like Bill said, has become who doesn't show up to the Pegasus rather than who is running it at night. There are a couple of different factors. It's a tough spot on the calendar because of its proximity to the Breeders' Cup Classic. And, you know, the Saudi Cup, the fatal flaw, I think, of the Pegasus was having the owners put up $1 million entry fees. That's the way they were able to get that enormous eye-popping $16 million purse at first, and then it dropped to 12, and now it's down to 3. Whereas in Saudi Arabia, like the people in Saudi Arabia who run these races have more money than God, so they don't care. They can put up $20 million and it's basically nothing to them. So that, you know, Gulfstream trying to run an actual business and make a profit, you know, they have a built-in disadvantage in that way, trying to compete with the Dubai World Cup or the Saudi Cup. And, you know, it's tough because the spot on the calendar is such that you don't, you kind of have to make a decision now whether or not you're going to bring a horse back for the entire season because of the Dubai World Cup and the Saudi Cup are shadowing the Pegasus. And when the Pegasus was basically standing on its own as a race that could compete with just the Dubai World Cup, you could run a horse in the Pegasus and then retire them to stud. Like City of Light did that. He ran in one of the Pegasus and then was able to stand stud that year. But now it's like, if you're going to run the Pegasus, it's almost a prep race for the Dubai World Cup and or the Saudi Cup. So it's like, Now you're forfeiting an entire breeding season as well if you want to go that route. And, you know, if you're going to do that, you might as well just have a fresh horse for the Saudi Cup and the Dubai World Cup. Why even do a three race schedule that early in the season? So yeah, there are a bunch of factors that I think have tamped down the field quality. I mean, I agree with Bill that I think it is a good event for the track, but I don't know. It's just the trajectory of it is not going in the right direction. I don't think the Saudi Cup is going to go away anytime soon. So, you know, I'll be watching because I'm a racing fan, like John said. I think overall in terms of breaking through on the national calendar, I think those days are over for the Pegasus.
And Joe, I'm sorry, John. Why wouldn't, I mean, the original idea was to have horses coming out of the Breeders' Cup and then running in this race and then going off to stud, which they can do. It works on the calendar. Why wouldn't people do that? And, you know, $3 million isn't that attractive. I mean, even some horse that ran third or fourth in the Breeders' Cup, you know, why wouldn't they come back and try this? But, you know, this is, again, an indictment of what this industry has become, that with high-class dirt male horses, racing is not important. All racing exists to be a showcase for the breeding shed. And it's gotten to the point where, you know, even $3 million, people just laugh at that. Oh, who cares? Let's just get them off at stud. Let's not, you know, throw any wrinkles into it. And, you know, again, I mean, that's something we've been talking about throughout this podcast from the beginning. It is kind of, you know, upsetting. And then the other thing too, and again, I talk about this 100 times, but why couldn't you run in the Pegasus and then go in the Saudi Cup? I mean, they're a month apart. You know, 5 years ago, a month was fine. Now you got to have 2 months off in between races. I mean, where is this all headed? You know, it's just gotten ridiculous.
And I think, you know, one of the things that they recognized when they initially thought about the race was that there was this kind of hole in the calendar. And we talk about it all the time. I mean, the past 2 weeks, we've been talking about, well, what else are we going to talk about on this podcast? So there's definitely a need for a race of this magnitude on the calendar at this point in time. And you know, the idea of having the owners put up the money and then, you know, I think the original concept was that you bought a post position placement and then you would have your horse run it, or you could actually lease it out or negotiate a deal with somebody who didn't have a position in the race and they could run their horse basically in your spot. And I remember, you know, when the race was initial, especially the first year, when the race was such a huge amount of money, there were all kinds of deals that were going on where, you know, farms in Kentucky were buying the post position spots to enter and then negotiating with racing operations to basically give them the spot to run in. And they were dealing back and forth with, hey, if you take my spot in the race, then I get a percentage of what you win. That was one deal. Or it means that you're going to stand your horse at my farm. If it finishes first, second, or third, we get right of first refusal. There were, you know, private plane offers that were going back and forth. I'll fly your contingent down to Miami, you know, in my private plane if you use my spot, because farms were handicapping it and saying, hey, you know, I may want this horse to stand at stud, or this is going to be a good return on investment for me, because if I put up the money and then the horse finishes in thinking the top four, I not only get my money back, but I get a profit. So it generated a lot of genuine interest in the industry and in the race. And I think it made a lot of people negotiate and talk, and that added a lot of energy to it. It's just, you know, for whatever reason, the past, you know, this year especially, it's just kind of a meh kind of field. And I think that, you know, I'm going to give, you know, the Sternet Group and Gulfstream Park additional credit by saying, I think they'll figure out something else. I think they'll be, you know, creative enough to be able to get some juice back into this race in the future, because the first couple of years, it had a tremendous amount of energy and interest.
Yeah. I mean, that was an interesting wrinkle to it, but you know, at the end of the day, $3 million is not going to compete with $20 million. And I agree with Bill that, you know, it shouldn't be that much to ask to run, you know, a month apart. But when you factor in the overseas trip, you factor in the a lot of times these are really valuable horses who you don't want to have any blemishes before they go to the breeding shed. I think, you know, it's just, you know, logically, I think people aren't going to take that risk. But, you know, the big selling point of the Pegasus was the purse, until you kind of thought about it and learned about it a little bit more. And the purse was, you know, it was funded by the people buying the entries. Whereas, like I said, you know, the Saudi Cup, they don't mind losing money on a $20 million race as long as they get the prestige of these great American dirt horses coming to run in their race. Like they don't really care about losing money in terms of that race. So they're up against it. You know, I think that Gulfstream does a really good job. I think Destronic Group overall does a really good job. So it's not as if like I'm rooting for this race to fail. I think that's where it's headed. I think it'll be eventually a $1 million race and you'll get these B level, you know, handicap horses to run in it. And it was a really good idea and it was an interesting idea. And I applaud them for trying something new and trying to make this a big date on the calendar. It hasn't worked out, I think, mostly because of circumstances beyond their control.
Ironically enough, Joe, I don't think, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think Maximum Security has still been paid the purse money that it won last year, right? I mean, so you go over there for the money, but we talked about it on this podcast. If they, for whatever reason, don't want to pay you, you don't have a leg to stand on. So that's a little, you know, concerning also in the grand scheme of things. Do I think they should pay, you know, the purses? That's a whole different, you know, therapy session, as I like to say, but they still haven't paid it yet from last year.
Well, and don't forget the bajillion-dollar fine they gave Mike Smith for overwhelming Midnight Bijou. I forget what it was. It was like $750,000 or something crazy like that. Right. So yeah, that's the risk you run, is that it's kind of the wild, wild west and they can do whatever they want. All right, so we did have a big derby prep. I'm not to say big, but one of the first significant derby preps of the season in the LeComp Stakes on Saturday at Fairgrounds. And, you know, it wasn't the most exciting race to watch because it was a merry-go-round, and I feel like that's something that's kind of plaguing horse racing right now in America, is, you know, jockeys who aren't aggressive and they just, you know, snatch and grab and, you know, go 1-2-3 around the track. It's obviously something that causes me endless frustration as a handicapper. Nevertheless, I thought you did have three pretty nice horses going at it in the stretch, and they were clear of fourth by a good margin. Midnight Bourbon was the horse who went wire to wire for Steve Asmussen. He was a horse that showed promise early on in his 2-year-old season, and then he was given a bit of a break and came back fresh to prepare for his 3-year-old season. I think he's an interesting horse going forward, but I think the top three are all potential Derby contenders. You got Proxy, who ran second for Godolphin. He's kind of the B team right now for Godolphin after Essential Quality, but I think, you know, he does have some quality of his own. And then Mandaloon, you know, he was wide. He was widest of the top three on both turns. I thought he finished up okay. It was a little disappointing to see him not get second, at least in there. But you know, you had three horses that I think could make some noise on the Derby trail and really separated themselves, which is different than usual with the LeComp Stakes. I feel like it's usually a total scramble with horses that might not be relevant going forward on the Derby trail. And then you had the Silver Bullet Day also on Saturday at Fairgrounds, which was interesting. We got an upset by Minnesota bred Charlie's Penny. So I always like to see those horses from those quote unquote lesser state breeding programs step up on the big stage and get it done for smaller connections as well. So any thoughts from you guys on the Saturday races at Fairgrounds?
Yeah, Joe, I thought the human element of the story was one of the more important things. And, you know, based on what he's done the last couple of years, I mean, Brad Cox is going to be a factor in any of these races, Phillies, Colts on a Saturday afternoon as we're getting approaching to the Kentucky Derby. And, you know, we've learned the guy's not perfect. He's just close to perfect. He sent out three to five favorites, Sunpath, in the Silver Bullet Day, and she was fourth. And then Mandolin was also 4-5 in there, and, you know, didn't run terribly, but, you know, certainly at 4-5, you would have expected more. So, you know, is Brad Cox ready to just be one of the dominant forces among trainers getting horses ready for the Kentucky Derby? I still think he is, but he had a minor setback. He took a step in the wrong direction. And also too, you know, these are nice horses, the horses that ran in the LeComp. But Joe, I got to think, come, you know, the first Saturday in May, I don't think we're talking about Midnight Bourbon and the rest of them. You know, this was not a stellar field, and you know, Midnight Bourbon's certainly a nice horse, but there's certainly also better horses out there.
So I think Bill just tipped his hand that he is not going to be picking Midnight Bourbon, at least in the first round of our contest. But Bill, I agree with you. I think we talked about it last year too, that some of these prep races You know, it's a misnomer. I mean, it's wonderful to say, okay, this is the first step of some of the Kentucky Derby contenders. But in reality, you're probably not going to see, you know, too many of these, if any, that are going to, you know, eventually graduate into the Triple Crown races. You guys already took the majority of the talking points as far as the importance of you know, the finishes and the Midnight Bourbon and Proxy and Mandaloon just went around like a merry-go-round, like Joe said, and it was the exact opposite in the Philly race in the Silver Bullet Day, where two horses came from a little off the pace to make a big run. But I credit Alan Carrasso, TDN's Alan Carrasso, for looking this up. He said there were under 100 Minnesota breds in that crop. And Charlie's Penny is already exceeding expectations, you know, out of the 100 that were born in the land of 10,000 lakes.
Yeah, Al's great at those little tidbits. He's almost obsessively great at it. So yeah, it was those write-outs that he does for the Graded Stakes. You can always find a good nugget or two in there. I wanted to also touch on, you know, Bill mentioned Brad Cox. The Smarty Jones Stakes is this weekend. That's the next decent Kentucky Derby prep at Oak Lawn. It's Friday, actually. It's not going to be Saturday, as most of these other preps are. But Brad Cox has a really interesting horse in there named Caddo River, who I made a TDN Rising Star. He's the son of Hard Spun. He was second in a really live-looking maiden race at Belmont after dueling at a really fast pace. And then he came back at Churchill and blitzed these maidens by 9.5 lengths. Got an 80-something buyer. He's very, very fast. But we're going to see how far he can take his speed. The Churchill race was a mile, but it was a one-turn mile, whereas Friday it's going to be a two-turn mile at Oak Lawn and the Smarty Jones. So he's an interesting horse. Also in that race is Cowan for Steve Asmussen. Now, he, I believe, was second in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf Sprint, and then he ran on dirt last time in the Springboard Mile and was second to my sleeper horse for the Derby, Senior Buscador, who I did a story on for Joe Peacock and his family. And he's a super, super interesting horse, was incredibly impressive in the Springboard Mile. So we're going to learn a little bit more about the quality of that field to see how Cowan runs in the Smarty Jones on Friday. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. And this is hard work. It's the hours put in before dawn and after dark. It's the sacrifice, the sweat, the failure, and the faith. This is our industry. This is our life's work.
Owning multiple Graded Stakes winning racehorses like Hard Not to Love and Decorated Invader is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. So last weekend, the Eclipse finalists came out. The Eclipse Awards are going to be January 28th, which is also my birthday. And there weren't too many surprises, but there was one finalist that I really had a bone to pick with. And I don't want to steal John's beat here, but Monowai Girl, I thought, really had no business being a Horse of the Year candidate. Now, she is obviously terrific. She's going to be the champion older filly. The older dirt female, and you know, I'm not gonna dump on her race record. Obviously, she's a win machine, so this isn't necessarily about her. But for her to be an Eclipse finalist over Swiss Skydiver to me is just absolutely crazy, because Monowai Girl ran four times in 2020, and considering that the first race she ran was an allowance race that was basically written for her, she essentially ran three times. And, you know, she had the La Troyenne win and the Breeders' Cup Distaff win. And then she had the Ruffian win, which is two grade ones and a grade two. Let's take a look at Swiss Skydiver's resume. I think she ran nine times. She won the Preakness, was the first filly to win the Preakness since Rachel Alexander. So she stepped outside the box there. She won the Alabama. She was dominant in the Alabama. She won the Fantasy. She won the Santa Anita Oaks. I'm sure I'm missing a race too that she won. She was all over the place. She shipped all over the country. She showed up every time. And I think Ken McPeak had an argument, at least, saying that she should be a horse of the year candidate. And for her to not even be on the podium, to me, is crazy. And it rewards campaigns like Modern White Girls, where they're just so careful and they pick their spots, you know, and just, you know, basically, other than the distaff run-in races that they know they're going to win, basically. Like, she kind of had to fall down to lose either of those other three races. And it's, I think, you know, to Bill's point earlier, and the point that he hammers over and over about how horses don't run frequently enough, I think that this kind of encourages that behavior and those kind of schedules, because, you know, there's no way you can look at Modern White Girl's resume in 2020 and Swiss Skydiver's resume in 2020 and say that she had, that Modern White Girl had the more impressive year. Now it's academic, because Authentic's going to win. Authentic's going to be horse of the year. So at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. But I was shocked to see that. And I think, you know, it's kind of just, I don't know, she's a fan favorite, Modern White Girl. And I think that they kind of deferred to that in making her a nominee for horse of the year. I wonder if you guys have any other thoughts.
Joe, I just want to add to what you said. To me, that was the biggest surprise as well. Not so much that I'm anti-Modern White Girl, but Swiss Skydiver, I mean, it's crazy that she's not among the top three. Now, first of all, again, it's really kind of all meaningless, because Authentic will be Horse of the Year. It's going to not even be a close race. And, you know, there is no prize for finishing second or third in the voting or anything like that. It's completely meaningless. But if you ask me who is the most obvious candidate to be second as horse of the year, or who is beyond Authentic is most deserving, I don't think there's any question it's Swiss Skydiver. You know, and matter of fact, if she had won the Breeders' Cup Distaff and Authentic won the Classic, I would have voted for her for horse of the year. But, you know, the difference was that she didn't win it. And again, you know, I think, to your point about Modern White Girl, people have lost sight of the year aspect of it. You know, which horse had the fullest, most productive campaign from January through the Breeders' Cup? Well, that is Swiss Skydiver, who also did some, you know, really historic things like winning the Preakness. Now, does she deserve it over Authentic? No, I didn't vote for her, but she absolutely should have been in the mix. And I think, you know, she was kind of to me, no brainer for the second best choice in there. Some other interesting things from the finalists. And I don't think Chad Brown deserved to be the Eclipse Award winner this year, but what has he won? Maybe four straight years or something like that. He did not make the top three as well in the trainer category. So, you know, some interesting things to talk about in there. But yeah, Swiss Skydiver did not get the credit she deserves.
And Bill, since out of the three of us, you're the only one who can actually, you know, cast an official vote. If you don't mind me asking, who did you end up voting for female turf horse of the year and male turf horse of the year? Because when I looked at all the different horse related, you know, groups, those two contingencies, I was like, nah, there just wasn't a head and shoulders horse in either of those two groups.
Well, particularly in the male turf category was, well, what are you going to do? You have to vote for somebody. I voted for Channelmaker. He was the only horse among the group that had two grade one wins, but he was 2-for-8 on the year. And boy, that's hard to put an Eclipse Award vote next to that horse. But one of the problems was that, you know, you want the Breeders' Cup turf races, be it the mile or the Breeders' Cup turf, to help you make up your mind. They were both won by European horses. You know, that no American horse was able to step forward in there. And I went for Rushing Fall in the female turf category. She did have, you know, that Diana win was pretty big. She ran well in the Breeders' Cup turf. But yeah, those were two of the categories, especially the male turf, where, you know, you really didn't feel good about voting for anybody.
Yeah, those two categories. And then the male sprinter also, you know, made me scratch my head a little bit, because, again, you're looking at horses that have really incomplete or truncated resumes for the year. Vekoma, you know, was 3 for 3 this year and won 2 grade ones. Volatile also 3 for 3 in 2020 and looked, you know, very impressive. But both of them retired in mid-summer. Both of them were done by like August 1st and never raced again for the remainder of the year. And Whitmore, to use a term that we talk about in baseball all the time, Whitmore was more of a grinder than he was, a compiler than he was brilliant. And yes, he won the Breeders' Cup Sprint and it was, you know, in 108 and change, but there were two horses on the same day that ran faster in Nashville and Gamine. And I know that, you know, you can't really make a case for Nashville to be, you know, put as the top three sprinters, for an Eclipse standpoint. But I think if you looked at it and said, who were the best sprinters in the country, Nashville and Gamine probably come atop your list before, the other ones that actually made the final three on the, on the actual docket. So it was just, again, 2020 is such a weird year because the whole, you know, racing calendar got flipped on its side and horses didn't really have a chance to compete during the course of the year. But to only run 2 or 3 or 4 times during the year and to make them, you know, on the Eclipse ballot, it really plays into what we've talked about before about how these unsound horses maybe finish their career and then go on to the breeding shed. Does it beget other horses that may have issues down the road? I think it falls back into what the Jockey Club was trying to accomplish by having, a change in the breeding rules.
Yeah, I mean, Whitmore was also sort of a process by elimination pick for me. And John, you've done this in the past. You got to stop this. Gamine is not a candidate.
I know. What I said was, if you asked me who the top sprinters were in the country, I would say Gamine. I didn't say that Gamine should be, you know, on the male sprinter. I understand there's different divisions. What I'm saying is, if you said who are the top three sprinters in the country, Gamine would be one of the top three sprinters.
Okay. Okay. And let's, this might be something that can generate some arguments. Some people have said that they're not voting for Gamine for the Philly sprint title because of the drug positives. I did not take that stand. I voted for her. First of all, the drug positives were in one race she lost in the Kentucky Oaks and another one was just in an allowance race at Oaklawn. So it's not like she got a drug positive in any of the races that you are giving her credit for and you are taking into consideration when you voted for her for the Eclipse Award. But she will get that title, Philly Mare Sprint, but it's not going to be unanimous for what I just said. And there's been some chatter out there about people wanting to penalize her and also in that respect, Bob Baffert as well for the two drug positives for her.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I was going to say, I have to stress to John that Gamine did not have a sex change. She can't be on the male sprinter podium. But yeah, I mean, that's... Bill brought up something I wanted to say about the champion trainer where, you know, he's not going to, I don't think he's going to win it. I think Brad Cox is going to win it, but I think it would, you know, generate a lot of negative attention if Bob Baffert were this year's champion trainer after the drug positives and the controversy that swirled around him in 2020. But also, like, when was the last time that neither Chad Brown nor Todd Pletcher were at least a finalist for Eclipse champion trainer? I mean, those two guys have basically own that award for the last decade almost. So I think that's a pretty interesting kind of balance of power shift. Obviously, you know, they both still had great years, especially Chad. You could have made a case for him as a finalist, but, you know, Brad Cox is going to win that. In terms of the male sprinter, I go back and forth. Al said this when he was on and we were talking about this last time, you know, when you don't have this dominant campaign, I think, you know, sometimes you might have to defer to who you thought was pound for pound the best horse in the category. And I think that was Volatile, even though he only ran a couple of times. I think, you know, it's hard to argue that he wasn't the best sprinter in the country, in America, at least in terms of talent, in terms of brilliance. Obviously it's hard to give an award to a horse who didn't run more than a couple of times. And Whitmore is, you know, he's, like I said this before, but he's like a lifetime achievement. I think he is going to win the male sprinter award. I think it's kind of a lifetime achievement video Vanguard award for the Eclipses. So I'm not going to complain too much if he wins, but I think it's hard to make the case that he was the best sprinter in America in 2020. Male turf is the tough one. I, you know, as much as I respect Channel Maker doing what he did at the age of 8, it's hard to really feel good about giving that kind of award to a horse like that, who also didn't win the Breeders' Cup. I think Rushing Fall is plenty deserving. The other two horses are basically, were just one time runners in America, Tarnawa and Ardaria. I think Tarnawa, you know, you can make a case for her because she did beat the boys in the Breeders' Cup Turf, but I think a lot of people for good reason are hesitant to pick these European horses that run once in America as American champions. And then female sprinter, you know, Gamine was the most brilliant female sprinter in the country. It's not even close. And whether or not you dock her points for those drug positives, there's nobody on the planet, I think, who could have run the kind of races that she ran in the Acorn and in the Filly and Mare Sprint. And the other two, you know, contestants like Serengeti Empress, obviously I have a lot of respect for her. She ran a great race in the Ballerina. She ran a great race in the Derby City Distaff, but you know, when push came to shove and she faced Gamine in the Filly and Mare Sprint, Gamine ran by her like she was standing still. So, and then the other one is Glass Slippers, who again is a Euro who only ran once and won the turf sprint. So I think Gamine is a no-brainer there, but you know, it's a good crop of horses that we got to see in 2020. Overall, just looking down the list, Authentic and Improbable was a three-time Grade One winner and is going to win Older Dirt Mail, but isn't going to win Horse of the Year. Essential Quality was one of the best two-year-olds I think we've seen in a while. Two-year-old fillies, like VQuist, is going to win because she's got the multiple Grade One wins. But I think you can make a case for Aunt Pearl because of just how dominant and impressive she was. And then the three-year-old males, you got Authentic, you got Tis the Law. I just think overall we were blessed to see a lot of really, really good horses in 2020. And I think unfortunately a lot of them, some of them at least, have been whisked off to the breeding shed, which is disappointing. But there are some that are still running that we're looking forward to seeing in 2021. But it was, you know, just looking at the finalists, we were really treated to a lot of great racing and a lot of great horses in 2020.
One more thing. Do you guys have any, or I should rephrase it, Bill, who did you vote for owner?
Godolphin. I think I those categories, I don't think anybody cares about.
Well, owners.
John's an owner.
Yeah.
But I was also looking at it and saying, all right, Godolphin had 300 and something starts and a 22 win percentage and a 50% of the money. Klarovich had earned $5.3 million in purses, 26 win percentage, 61% of the money. And then the partnership of Spendthrift et al. Had one horse, basically. And that's why. So to me, I was like, it's tough to give it to the owner who had one horse versus, yeah, because these guys own a ton of horses. It wasn't like it was, you know, a one horse stable and these guys, you know, only had enough money for one horse and the horse ended up being, you know, a superstar. Then I can understand, all right, you give it to them because there's a great story there. But all these guys are major owners, you know, separate of this partnership. And it was just like, why give it to the one horse partnership?
It is weird to see that the three owners' names on the finalist list. Yeah, thought that was a little bit weird. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills, fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at greenco.com. So our Green Group Guest of the Week this week is the spectacular TV host of America's Day at the Races, Gulfstream Park, Acacia Courtney. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. Busy week getting ready for the Pegasus World Cup, but it's a fun one as it always is.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're all looking forward to it. So I wanted to start with this. I think you did great work, and I think everybody did great work on America's Day at the Races. I thought it was a really important thing to have that on the air every day, especially when there was no other sports going on and racing kind of had the spotlight to itself. kind of wanted to know about your experience working on that show and whether or not you've gotten any feedback from people maybe outside of the racing sphere who tuned in because there was nothing else going on and saw you guys.
Yeah, we really got so much positive feedback from it, which was really appreciated because obviously it's our jobs and we love our jobs and we're very lucky to have them, particularly this year throughout the pandemic. But it was really special that we were able to continue bringing the excitement and the love of horse racing to people who were either longtime fans or people that were newer to the game, given that there wasn't really much else to watch as far as live sports and live action. And, you know, being a part on that show of the Belmont Stakes, which was the first major sporting event to happen in New York after everything was shut down for the pandemic. And then, of course, making Saratoga happen. Obviously, it was a unique year and it was a very kind of bittersweet time to be at Saratoga because it just wasn't the same without the crowd and the fans and the people in the backyard. But we were getting people tweeting at our show. We were doing the hashtag Your Summer Place each week where we saw people having their own kind of Saratoga setups in their backyard or what have you, or how they were able to watch and feel like they were there with us. So it was, you know, it was a lot of work because we were kind of a skeleton crew and we were trying to, you know, bring everything that was so special about the races home to people. So it was a little bit exhausting, but at the same time, it was so fulfilling and I'm so grateful to be part of it. And I just really hope that we're able to have the fans back, particularly at a place like Saratoga next year.
Hey, Acacia, thanks so much for joining us. So, hey, I think people need to know a little bit more about how you prepare for a day at the races. And I did a TDN story on you a couple of years ago. And what really came across is that you are almost have like a religious fervor for how you pack a card, the work you do. I mean, there was even comments that you forgone your social life because you were so hard on the races. So tell people a little bit about, you know, what you'll do, particularly a card for like the Pegasus, where, you know, there's so many horses. What will you do in the days before leading up to it so that you can hopefully give some winners out on Saturday?
Well, the Pegasus is kind of unique because I'm aware for a few weeks leading up who is going to be in the race. And then as horses are either dropping out or being drawn in from the also eligible list, I keep track of all of that. And I'm doing some stories on the connections and feature videos and things like that. So those races, I feel like I have a pretty good handle on it. We're filming on Wednesday. Today, we're drawing the Pegasus races. We'll also draw the balance of the 12 race card. So those other 10 races, I'll need to spend a lot of time on. Tonight in particular, but the biggest thing for me, I go through, especially maiden races or higher level allowance races, surface switches, especially turf races. I look through the pedigree. If it's a two-year-old or three-year-old race with a first-time starters in there, I'll go to the sales page, whether it's Keeneland, Phasic, Tipton, Ocala, whatever it is, bought in Europe. I'll look through the pedigree. I'll look through the families, see if there's any kind of clues in there. I'll watch workouts if they're available on XBTV or from those sales. And especially if it's a horse that I've seen before, I take notes on each of the horses that I see every time I see them. Even when I'm on the desk hosting, I try to jot down notes or any comments that my colleagues say or notice about the horses too. So I have something to go back on next time. And those are really helpful tools for me. But yeah, I'm a very thorough workhorse, so to speak. So it may take me a little bit longer, but I would never want to show up at Gulfstream or in New York, whatever show I'm doing, feeling like I was unprepared or giving out opinions to the public that would be betting their money, anything that I wasn't completely certain of, that I had spent enough time really looking at it.
And Acacia, it's John Green. And as somebody who's stuck in their desk in New Jersey, having horses running, you know, all over different venues, I really appreciate, you know, the insight that you give us for those of us who aren't able to be on the racetrack. And you know, so thank you for that. One of the things that I've noticed over the past couple of months with you, you know, doing the analytics, the pre-race analytics, is that you've gotten much more, I think, confident about saying, hey, that horse looks great in the paddock, or that horse is really warming up really well. And then it ultimately, you know, does well during the race. Today, in today's day and age, the trend is to go with super trainers. Are there any under the radar trainers that maybe you watch their horses come in the paddock, you know, and say, wow, that horse is in good flesh, or that horse is really on its toes. I have to take a note because this is an up and coming trainer that people should know about.
Yeah, I think you can really see that when you follow a circuit really closely. So this is now my fifth winter doing Gulfstream Park. So I'm able to kind of get some of the feel for some of the local trainers here that stay in Florida year round a lot more. And then now spending more time up in New York, I was able to really kind of pick up on some things that maybe I hadn't noticed before with some of those smaller barns that maybe don't have a lot of horses, but their horses just really look so great every time. Down here in Florida, a big one for me is Kathleen O'Connell, who does a really good job both at Gulfstream and up in Tampa as well. And her horses, sometimes it almost makes my job a little bit more difficult because their horses always look so well turned out and look so healthy. But, you know, she really gets in a good groove. And I think that's something to take note of as well when a barn's just doing well and all of the horses really seem to be running true to form. And that's what I've been noticing from Kathleen in particular right now throughout the meet. She's one that really comes to mind. You have some others that are local to Florida, like Safi Joseph, that have really kind of turned into almost a right under the cusp super trainer, you know, kind of building up to that level with a lot more horses and things like that, people taking notice. But I'd say Kathleen is a local Florida trainer that I always look out for her horses and like trying to bet them. Up in New York, I'd say, you know, somebody like Mertkan Cantormasi. Robert Amendola had a lot of horses with him and Jose Gallegos in Florida. And I've noticed that the Cantormasi family in New York love trying to find their horses off the claim or off a layoff. I mean, they just always really seem to put on weight when they're with them. They really seem to show up well, and they seem to be spotted well, too. They had a very strong Saratoga. So that's a barn that I had really picked up on for a smaller trainer.
All right, I'm going to put you on the spot here and ask you to put on your marketing hat, because I think as someone who is on TV and is kind of one of the faces of racing, I feel like you probably would know a little bit about this, because you work for two places, I think Naira and Gulfstream, that do a good job of marketing the sport. But I think overall in racing, we could stand to do a lot better of marketing racing, especially to younger people. Do you have any ideas or anything that you've picked up along the way that you think that racing could be doing better to bring new people into the sport?
I don't think we should do fans the disservice of really dumbing it down too much. There's a lot of information and it can be a lot kind of thrown at you all at once. But I think people enjoy the puzzle of trying to figure it out. And I think that's one thing that's really so fun about racing is that, you know, you never really know what you're doing. You know, we're all kind of faking it until we make it, I think, even if we've done a lot of research and done a lot of work into it. You look at any major sport on TV and they give you all of the stats. They give you, you know, the players' backgrounds and their info and what they've done for that season or their career. And I think that information will really help people quite a bit, because if they look just, you know, first and foremost at the program when they arrive there on their first day, they have no idea what's going on. So I think giving access to information and giving tools to be able to read that information a little bit easier is definitely something that I think will help with fans. I know in the past, when I've been able to bring friends to the track, you know, once you kind of teach them exactly what's going on and then you just kind of leave them to have fun, they come back at the end of the day, hey, I hit this, or I was beat by a nose in this race or something like that. And then once you know how the process works or how to bet, then it becomes fun and you're able to do that. I love these big day events, you know, like, Saturdays at Saratoga, the Pegasus World Cup, the Florida Derby. Those are, I think, a good taste of what the racing is. And like I said, it's a model. It's the same kind of idea, but it's happening all around the world in so many different places. I really think that there is something for everybody.
Okay, so switching gears a little bit, why don't you tell people about your charity, Racing for Home, the background of that and what's going on with that charity, Horse Rescue Charity, today?
Yeah, we are a 501c3 called Racing for Home, Inc. Started back in 2011 with my mother. I was very young at the time when I kind of wanted to do something about a topic that bothered me, and I didn't really know what I was getting into. But it's been one of my most rewarding experiences. And back in 2019, we were accredited by the Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance, which has 74 aftercare organizations of its kind accredited under that umbrella. And they have very, very high standards. So that had been a big goal of mine and something I was incredibly proud of. And we currently have 10 horses in our care. So we do rehabilitation, we do sanctuary, we try to adopt horses out to new careers, whether that's being a show horse or a therapeutic riding horse, really kind of cover all of it. And we are on the smaller scale, but for each individual horse that we're able to work with and help, it really means the world to that horse for sure. And kind of circling back to Joe's question too about marketing the sport to new fans, I think aftercare is a major piece of that as well, because it's my opinion that until we put aftercare a priority all the time and show that we are putting the emphasis on our equine athletes while they're racing and while their racing days are over, I don't think we'll be able to ever really market the sport to people, because we have to show that the horses are the number one priority throughout their entire lives.
Very well said, Acacia. I think that we sometimes we lose sight of the fact that these are athletes and that we have to treat them, and they don't have a voice. So by you establishing a nonprofit to give them an opportunity to live out their life afterwards, after the racing career is over, is outstanding. I think it's very needed in the industry. One last question for you, and with the Pegasus Day coming up, and obviously it's a big weekend at Gulfstream. Is that your favorite day of the year, or are there other race days where you say, I really look forward to blank day, Florida Derby Day, or, because of the pageantry, whatever it is, what is like your favorite day on the racing calendar?
The Preakness Stakes, without a question. I've always loved the Preakness. And this year, of course, a different type of Preakness with it wrapping up the Triple Crown. But I think that stretch run between Authentic and Swiss Skydiver really delivered too. And even without a crowd there on Preakness Day, it's always been one of my favorite races. We used to go with my family as a fan, before I really got into the industry. And typically in the middle of the Triple Crown races, it just feels like it really has that excitement and that special part of it, but it's the most fun. And I really love Maryland racing. Through working through the Stronach Group, I've gotten to spend some time at Pimlico and at Laurel, and the people in Maryland are great. There's so much pride in Maryland for the Preakness, and it's just always a day on the calendar I really look forward to.
All right, I have one last question, and if you don't have a strong opinion on it, no problem, because I don't think we've really dived into it that much either. But the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act, big news that passed a couple of weeks ago. As someone who's on the ground, who sees racing up close and personal every single day, how big of an impact do you think that can have on the sport?
I don't really know just yet, but I am hopeful. I think that's the best kind of way that I'm looking at it. I do think that there needs to be reform and uniformity, most importantly, throughout the sport of horse racing. I think that there is something positive to be said about the different jurisdictions and the different tracks having some unique features to them. But especially when it comes to medication and the way that tracks approach sanctions or whatever it may be, as far as the connections and how they are approaching the sport of horse racing, I think that has to be uniform. Again, looking back to other sports, we have the NHL, the NFL, the NBA, there's always kind of an overarching group or individual that makes sure that things are uniform. And I think it'll also take a lot of the guesswork out for people as well, and shipping horses to other tracks. It might actually make more of an appeal, to ship out to Santa Anita or down to Florida or up to New York, whatever, for this big race, because exactly what to expect. It will take the guesswork out for veterinarians, for owners, for trainers, for everybody involved. So that's my hope for it.
Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for the insight. Best of luck this week.
Thank you very much. Thanks, guys. Take care.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Acacia Courtney will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over four decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
So we were just talking to Acacia Courtney about the excellence of marketing that the Stronach Group does with regard to big race weekends like Pegasus. And we just thought that, you know, we would kind of pump up their most recent ad on the Pegasus with some really good looking people instead.
All right, so that's going to do it for the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland this week. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group guest of the week, Acacia Courtney, our producer, Patty Wolf, and our editors, Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Danny Seiper. Thanks for watching. Please wear a mask. We'll see you next week.